You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Welcome to this vodcast on understanding treatment decisions and management for patients with advanced renal cell carcinoma using hypothetical case studies. I'm Dr. Olga Vaishampayan. I'm a medical oncologist focused on GU cancers at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And with me is Dr. Benjamin Garmezy. Ben, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Ben Garmezy. I'm a GU medical oncologist practicing here at SCRI Oncology Partners in Nashville, Tennessee, and also tasked with helping lead the GU research program for Sarah Cannon Research Institute.
Great. So starting with an overview of the topics to be covered, a brief overview of the treatment landscape of advanced RCC, we will talk about presentation of hypothetical case studies, including discussion of treatment approaches, therapy management, and management of adverse events. A review of clinical trials supporting the benefit of combination therapy in advanced RCC. So moving on to advanced RCC and the treatment landscape, until 2005, the approved treatments for advanced RCC were interleukin-2 and interferon alpha, which were non-selective in their mechanism of action and produced response rates in only about 15 and 12% of the patients, respectively. In recent years, an unprecedented number of medical advances have revolutionized the systemic treatment of kidney cancer, especially for patients with advanced RCC. Combinations of immuno-oncology agents and tyrosine kinase inhibitors, TKIs, as they call them, and IO-TKI, so which is immuno-oncology, immune therapy along with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and IO-IO combinations, which is two immune checkpoint therapy combination, are now approved for either first or second line treatment of advanced RCC.
Yes, thank you. Axitinib plus pembrolizumab was the first vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, IO-TKI combination approved for the first-line treatment of advanced RCC by the FDA in 2019, showing a sustained clinical benefit compared with the previous standard of care, which was sunitinib in that control arm. Furthermore, axitinib and pembrolizumab is a recommended treatment in the guidelines of the NCCN, the European Association of Urology, and the European Society for Medical Oncology for first-line treatment of advanced RCC in all risk groups. However, there are additional options as well in frontline therapy for clear cell RCC. Additional recommended immunotherapy combinations in the first line include the immunotherapy doublet with ipilimumab, an anti-CTLA-4 agent, plus nivolumab, an anti-PD-1 agent, as well as two other IO-TKI combinations, cabozantinib plus nivolumab or lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab. Combinations such as nivolumab plus ipilimumab, nivolumab plus cabozantinib, avelumab plus axitinib, and lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab have all received FDA approval and will be discussed during the course of this podcast. This podcast will primarily report cases and management of frontline renal cell carcinoma with IO-TKI combination treatment, and will touch on the immunotherapy doublet for a brief amount of time as well.
We are going to be talking about this topic of discussion of treatment options in advanced renal cell carcinoma with two hypothetical cases. Starting with the first case, this is a 68-year-old man who presents with flank pain, dyspnea, and cough. Past medical history includes hypertension and angina that occurred about 18 months ago. Patient had cardiac ischemia at the time, and he had a cardiac cath and angioplasty, and two stents were placed. The patient feels well now and has not had angina since, and there is no history of arrhythmia. Non-smoker, uses alcohol occasionally, no relevant family history of cancer. Currently, he is taking statin, lisinopril, and irbesartan for hypertension, and is on aspirin and Plavix. Chest X-ray shows multiple bilateral lung nodules, the largest being about 1.8 centimeter. CT confirms these bilateral lung lesions, It also shows hilar lymphadenopathy of about 3 centimeter and right renal mass of about 8 centimeter. His Karnofsky performance score is 80%, and hemoglobin, complete blood count, and calcium are all normal. Image-guided biopsy of the lung mass shows clear cell histology consistent with metastatic renal cell carcinoma. The patient has intermediate risk RCC per the International Metastatic Disease Consortium or IMDC criteria. One risk factor that is noted makes him intermediate risk, and that one risk factor is synchronous metastatic disease with primary renal cancer. So, Ben, can you discuss some of the points and the clinical factors on this about this patient that would influence your determination of treatment options?
I think you set the stage really well for this case. This is intermediate risk by the IMDC, and I know that there's a lot of controversy in some of the GU medical oncology community about how much should we be relying on IMDC or MSKCC risk stratification for selecting therapy, knowing that the immunotherapy doublet is approved in intermediate and poor risk as far as guideline-directed therapy, though you could get it for a favorable risk patient if you wanted. It is listed in the NCCN as an other recommended option. And also knowing that the IO TKI combinations, there's three that are recommended, we've discussed earlier, to abbreviate pembro-axi, cabo-nivo, and pembro-lenvima or lenvatinib for these patients. So in this case, you have intermediate risk and you could use all four. Now, how I like to think about this is the IO TKIs are more similar than different, and then the immunotherapy doublet is kind of separate from those options. How do we pick the right IO TKI combination? Again, there's never the right choice or the wrong choice, and they're all reasonable, and they all have slightly different utility. This patient has known cardiac ischemia, has had a history of hypertension on two antihypertensive medications, on a statin for, assumingly hyperlipidemia or CAD, swollen Plavix. So this patient does have some cardiac risk. Now, all of those TKIs that we use can have increased cardiac risk for our patients, whether that's changes in arrhythmia, changes in actually the healing based on taking away that VEGF can actually cause the way the arteries in the heart actually remodel. So there are some increased cardiac risk factors. That being said, most of our patients in clinic have cardiac risk factors and go safely on IO TKI combination. So I think it would be reasonable. When I think about that, setting that stage, I'll toss it back to you and say, when would you use an IO-IO combination? Would you consider that for this patient with intermediate risk? Or would you think an IO TKI doublet would be more reasonable?
I think the IO-IO combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab may be a little bit too toxic potentially for this patient. This patient already has somewhat limited reserve because of the cardiac issue that is relatively recent, 18 months ago. He is still on anticoagulation. He had recent stents. So I would be a little bit nervous about doing combination ipilimumab and nivolumab. The other thing is his disease does not appear to be terribly bulky and requiring immediate type of symptomatic based management. But based on just my concern about the immune-related adverse events and the patient not having adequate reserve to tolerate those, which clearly increase in incidence and severity with the IO-IO combination, I would prefer to go with the IO-TKI combination. Again, which IO-TKI, that is a tough question. Each of them, as we know, none of them have been compared to each other. All of them have been only compared to sunitinib, which was the default treatment at the time. I would consider that because this patient has hypertension and cardiac disease, which TKIs clearly have been shown to aggravate or worsen at times. I would prefer an agent with a relatively short half-life like axitinib because it allows us to reverse the toxicity relatively quickly rather than a longer-acting agent in this case.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So, I use all three IO TKI combinations in my clinic, and I use
Sure.
them a little differently. I think axitinib does have that benefit of the short half-life. So, in those patients where you think you might run into trouble with the VEGF toxicity, axitinib is nice because you can turn it off fairly quickly by holding it, and then sometimes even be able to hold off on giving high-dose steroids if you're unsure if it's an immunotherapy toxicity or a VEGF TKI-based toxicity. That is the one benefit of axitinib, knowing that cabozantinib and lenvatinib have much longer half-lives. That being said, there's also some difference in the toxicity profiles. When you think about the VEGF selectivity of these three agents, axitinib is more VEGF selective compared to cabozantinib and lenvatinib, which are slightly more multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitors in the sense that they hit more of PDGFR, FGFR, the TAM kinase receptors. That does change the toxicity profile a little bit. Perhaps you get a little bit more of the PPE and some of the GI side effects with some of those other agents compared to axitinib. Axitinib does have a slightly more clean profile, though you can also see elevated LFTs. Obviously, you see a lot of hypertension and fatigue with all of these drugs. So those are things to keep in mind. And I think when we start talking about how are we going to mitigate cardiac risk in this patient with known cardiac risk factors and safely select a TKI, I think sending a patient home with a home blood pressure cuff, telling them to pick it up from their local drugstore, their local pharmacy, so that they can help be a partner in the mitigation of that risk instead of relying on seeing them in clinic, in our busy clinics, wondering what's white coat hypertension and what's real hypertension. I think it's easy to have everyone you start go home, with those blood pressure cuffs. And when starting to think about, we've been talking about the IO TKIs. You've given some reasons why maybe you wouldn't want to give ipilimumab in this patient. I think when I give an immunotherapy doublet, it's more in patients with sarcomatoid biology, those patients that are kind of that you feel are going to need that ipilimumab. So sarcomatoid rhabdoid features are features that we know are more immune sensitive relative to the VEGF sensitivity. I think it's critical to offer those patients immunotherapy doublet. I think otherwise, we hear this conversation about ipilimumab and nivolumab perhaps increasing durability of a response, but you do sacrifice that initial response rate. Now, what I think we don't know for sure yet is how much that ipilimumab is still adding. Obviously, that data set that got approved with 8-year follow-up that Dr. Tanir presented at GU ASCO in 2024 was exciting to see continued durability in a large patient subset. So there's definitely a role in some patients for ipilimumab. What we don't know is who are those patients in that subset. So I think it's still harder to figure that out. I think sarcomatoid biology is probably one of those important factors. I also think there's more data on coming about the role of ipilimumab on studies currently out there, like 8x8. So we'll learn more about when we should probably be giving ipilimumab versus not giving ipilimumab in the near future. I think another question that comes up in a patient like this, metastatic disease, but a very large, renal tumor. When would you consider cytoreductive nephrectomy? Would you ever consider it? Would you do it prior to systemic therapy, after a nice response? How do you think about that?
I think cytoreductive nephrectomy and the sequence of it has really changed over the times. So initially, in the era of cytokine therapy, cytoreductive nephrectomy showed improvement in overall survival as compared to not doing the nephrectomy and just putting the patient on systemic therapy. At that time, the systemic therapy was interferon alpha, which has like a 3% response rate. So we had very limited systemic therapy options at that time. Now the study, a randomized trial called CARMINA, sort of changed that paradigm. And this was a study in the context of sunitinib therapy, where patients were randomized to upfront nephrectomy versus just going on systemic therapy with sunitinib. And that study actually showed that there was not any survival benefit. In fact, 20% of the patients did not get to the systemic therapy that they really needed. So because of that, upfront cytoreductive nephrectomy should not be considered in majority of the synchronous metastatic disease patients. I think if they have majorly symptomatic disease, significant hematuria that you cannot quite control, or major pain for a resectable tumor, then those may be areas where you could consider. Also, limited metastatic disease where you can resect it. For instance, if the same side adrenal gland has a mass that is involved with cancer, and that's the only site of metastasis, you could consider upfront cytoreductive nephrectomy or a solitary metastasis elsewhere too. That is resectable. So, for the most part, I would say right now in immune checkpoint therapy, and as our systemic therapy is getting better and better over the years, it seems like upfront cytoreductive nephrectomy should not be done. There is a clinical trial, SWOG 1931, or the PROBE trial, that is currently exploring the role of cytoreductive nephrectomy in the setting of immune checkpoint-based combination therapy. So consideration of that trial, but everyone ideally should go on systemic therapy first. At about 12 to 16 weeks, you start looking at, depending on their response and benefit from the therapy, you can start considering cytoreductive nephrectomy.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. That's kind of what we're doing in the community out here in Tennessee, right? So I'm in a community-based practice working with community-based urologists outside of my practice, kind of a real-world experience. And we like to get patients started on therapy unless they're symptomatic, as you mentioned. Hematuria that's not resolving is another big one, another big reason to do a cytoreductive nephrectomy. But, we're looking at that 6 to 9 month mark. Does a patient have a CR or a near CR, that kind of 80% threshold of reduction of all the metastatic disease outside the primary? Those patients are then being considered for a cytoreductive nephrectomy in our clinic. Now, is that the right way to be doing it? We're not sure. But that is how we're doing it currently. And of course, we await more data to better, hone our skills and our practice on how to manage these patients. Yeah, great.
So we talked about adverse events. You did mention, and that's an excellent idea that people should use, is monitoring the blood pressure, having patients do daily monitoring, et cetera. What other adverse events are you looking at, and how are you following for them?
I mean, I think the big one is management of the GI toxicity, right? So those aren't that hard to manage, right? Because they don't always, the only one that's harder is the diarrhea, because that can be overlapping with the immunotherapy and the VEGF TKI. So thinking about sending everyone home with Imodium, it describing how they use it, the bottle is confusing, and it also, isn't as much as they often need sometimes for VEGF TKI. Now, when is that point to start thinking about, is diarrhea immune related? So I tell my patients, use Imodium this way, take two in the morning, take one every few hours after that. But I want to know if you're having more than five stools, right? So if you're having four or less, then you can manage it at home. Even if that's a smoldering immune-related diarrhea, we'll catch that in clinic. We'll see how it's going. But if they start having five, that's when I need to know about it. That's when I need to start tracking it. And that is not a number that is dogmatic in practice. That's a number that's worked for me in my clinic. I feel like everyone's patient population is a little bit different. Now, let's say you have a patient with a smoldering rheumatoid arthritis or some kind of mild immune risk factor, we should say. Well, those patients you're going to watch even more closely, because what we know from the literature is while you can have an exacerbation of that, whatever that immune is, so if you have a mild psoriasis, skin disease, or if a mild rheumatoid arthritis, arthritic disease, you can also more likely get an immune-related toxicity in a separate organ. So those patients are going to need a little bit more close monitoring. I don't know, do you have any other thoughts to add to that about how you proactively manage the toxicity?
No, I think pretty much similar to what you're doing management-wise, but I would say that usually I hold both agents, depending on, how severe it is, and if it's not quickly controlled with whatever anti-motility agent you're using, I think I hold both therapies and then sort it out, because the TKI-based toxicity will reverse relatively quickly once you hold it. The immune-related toxicity will not. And the same principle, I guess, I use for transaminitis, which is another common finding where the liver enzymes start going up with the combinations of TKI and IO. Again, if it starts improving quickly, that's TKI related. If it's not, then it's time to use steroids and immunosuppression. The other thing to remember is for TKI-based toxicities, if they are severe enough and to rechallenge the patient, it is very easy to alleviate the toxicity with lowering the dose. Not so for immune checkpoint therapy, obviously. So that there, the rechallenge, you would have to wait and make sure the patient has improved and stabilized appropriately. And if that happened quickly enough, the steroid therapy turned them around relatively quickly, you can consider rechallenge gradually. And then I guess the
Yeah, please.
last thing that we need to address is how do you monitor for treatment response?
Generally, it's simple for me. It's scans, and I'm generally doing it every 3 months. Now, if patients have been stable for a very long time, say they're now on, immunotherapy for over a year and a half or so, I'll start decreasing the interval of the scans, but generally at first it's every 3 months.
I agree with you. That's pretty similar. And sometimes, if they start off with major symptomatic disease, just resolution of the symptoms or improvement in the symptoms will give you a clinical clue that the patient is improving.
Yeah, absolutely.
All
Okay, we'll move on to case study two. So this is a 66-year-old female who presents with 6 weeks of painless hematuria. Past medical history includes hypertension, well controlled on lisinopril, hyperlipidemia, and a hysterectomy. No family history of cancer. Imaging reveals a 10.5-centimeter left renal mass, and complete staging imaging is negative for spread of disease, and patient undergoes just left radical nephrectomy. There's no extension into any major veins or perinephric tissues, and she is staged as PT2B and 0 with histologic grade 3 disease. No adjuvant therapy is offered, and she's placed on surveillance. She does well for 15 months until a new persistent cough develops that does not go away. A CT chest is ordered, and three pulmonary lesions are found, the largest being 3.5 by 3.2 centimeters. Additional staging imaging is concerning for recurrent disease in at least four lymph nodes in the abdomen, the largest measuring 3.8 centimeters. Upon review, it is determined that metastatectomy and radiation are not appropriate given the location of the disease and the amount of disease. Karnofsky performance status is 90. Labs are within normal limits, and the patient is determined to have IMDC favorable risk. So this is different than that first case where we had intermediate risk disease. This is favorable risk disease. Part of that being, right, because the disease didn't show up for 18 months. So it's outside that 1 year window, which is a risk factor in the IMDC criteria. So that's what differentiates this case, the favorable versus intermediate. What I would love for you to provide us some insight, and some of that was in that case, is you decide that it's not okay to provide radiation or metastatectomy. When are you considering in low risk disease using radiation or doing surgery instead of providing systemic therapy? Are there any kind of cutoffs or criteria that you're using?
I think for the most part, how slow growing the disease is and how long it took for it to be metastatic. The other things that are clues is the location of the metastases. You know, pancreas, thyroid metastases tend to be very, very slow growing, spell for a prolonged course in the patient. And that's why those might be areas where I would be more likely to consider surgical resection or local therapy. With lymph node metastases that cannot be adequately radiated, I think it is tough, and in an otherwise very healthy patient whose really long-term course is going to be dictated by the metastatic disease, I think systemic therapy, now we have evidence that it can allow long-term remission rates with 8, 9 years follow-up where patients have prolonged survival with complete remission. So, because of that long-term remission rate, I think systemic therapy would make sense in this patient.
I agree. Most of my patients in favorable risk disease are getting systemic therapy. We know there is that phase two data set out of MD Anderson that was published, I think it was in 2021, that suggests that you can safely radiate patients, watch them, and delay the time where they progress and need systemic therapy. So that's reasonable in a patient with oligometastatic disease, something that's easy to radiate, maybe two, three lesions. But once you start talking about nodal disease and everything else, it just gets so much more difficult. And then when thinking about surgery, obviously that's a whole different conversation. That's at your GU tumor board if you have access to one. Is this an easy surgery? Is this not an easy surgery? But I feel like more often than not, in these metastatic patients, it's harder to accomplish those goals for the majority of patients. And then when thinking about systemic considerations, you know, we talked about in favorable risk disease, what's interesting about all of these IO-TKI combinations, as well as the immunotherapy doublet combination, that OS in these subset analyses doesn't actually beat single agent TKI and sunitinib in this case, right? With all four of these trials that we're talking about being with the control arm sunitinib. So how do you decide whether to give a single agent TKI monotherapy? Do you ever do that? Or do you always provide doublets in patients who are candidates for immunotherapy?
Yeah, I think for the most part, because of the possibility of long-term remission, we know about TKIs, we have used them for decades. And what we do know is that there is a very good response rate, there is a possibility of complete response, although small, about 5% or less. And that long-term remissions, even after stopping therapy, are exceedingly rare. So because of that finding, I think it does make sense to at least offer to the right otherwise healthy patient who is a candidate for immune checkpoint therapy, the combination treatment.
Yeah, I completely agree. I only use single agent TKI monotherapy in patients who are not candidates for immune therapy. And even in some patients that quote unquote have those risk factors, like a mild rheumatoid arthritis or a mild, say, elbow psoriasis, right? Something like that. I try to give immunotherapy to those patients because it does provide that chance of durability. Now, when we look at those curves, yes, they are somewhat overlapping between sunitinib and IO-TKI doublets. So one can make the argument that TKI monotherapy is reasonable in favorable risk patients. And I can't say that that's incorrect, right? But what I can say is we all think that there's patients that are not being captured well by IMDC criteria that are going to be immune responsive. And that doesn't always apply to the median or the average patient, but it applies to those subsets that we're really trying to give a chance at durable remission, being alive 5, 10 years later, maybe even cure in a very, very small subset of patients, right? So for me, it's hard because to just look at lab values and say that we're not going to give you an immunotherapy or a chance at immunotherapy. So that's just my practice. It sounds like your practice is similar. And I know that most GU medical oncologists are providing doublets to their patients. Now, in this patient with favorable risk, though, you know, we talked about hypertension a lot in the first case. We've talked about diarrhea. What we haven't talked about it so much is the hyperthyroid and the hypothyroidism and how we determine if that's from the IO or the TKI, or does it even matter? So let's say you have a patient with hypothyroidism. Are you pausing treatment or are you just providing agents to treat that hypothyroidism?
Yeah, so hypothyroidism is relatively easy to treat. You can just replace and start them on the thyroid replacement therapy and continue them on treatment. So that usually will not warrant a hold in the treatment. In fact, I monitor for their thyroid function about every 12 weeks or so, unless there are symptoms that are suggesting to me that this may be from hypothyroidism, severe fatigue, for instance, or of course the hyperthyroidism-based symptoms, again, fatigue, but you know, the tachycardia and things like that can be clues of hyperthyroidism also. If the patient has hyperthyroidism, it may be considered to stop depending on how severe it is. But for the most part, if they have symptomatic hyperthyroidism, the recommendation would be to give them beta blockers and continue or use methimazole, things like that, to reverse the hyperthyroidism. And then eventually, though, that patient is going to get hypothyroid, and you will need to use a thyroid supplement.
Yeah, I think that's really good nuance there. So hypothyroidism, very easy to treat. We don't need to spend too much time discussing that. The hyperthyroidism is more challenging, perhaps more alarming to a community medical oncologist that maybe treats a lot of breast cancer or benign heme that aren't as familiar with these agents.
Yes.
What I would say is most of those patients with hyperthyroidism are not symptomatic. And it's just a lab value. And you can just continue to treat through it, knowing that they're going to burn out and become hypothyroid relatively soon. In this case, when I see signs of biochemical hyperthyroidism, I am just checking the thyroid labs more frequently with every cycle, watching that happen. and also telling them that they are at risk, and if they develop palpitations or any other of the symptoms of hyperthyroidism, that they need to notify us immediately. Now, a patient with symptomatic hyperthyroidism, you absolutely need to hold therapy, manage the hyperthyroidism, wait for them to burn out, become hypothyroid before you resume. So I think that was a very good distinction that you brought up here. And it's sometimes hard to tell, is it from the TKI or from the immunotherapy, right? Because both of those can cause it. And I think the only thing is, if you think it might be immunotherapy related, sometimes providing steroids to help with the management of that is critical. Now, in a symptomatic patient and you're not sure which one, I generally always provide the immune suppression, because those patients that are admitted in the hospital with bad cardiac issues, you don't really have time to figure that out, right? So we've kind of talked about a lot about this patient. We've talked about providing radiation and surgery in low risk disease. I think one thing that we haven't talked about is sometimes surveillance is even appropriate in some favorable risk patients who don't want to intervene in their disease, just watching them very closely. I scan them every 3 months if that's the case.
Absolutely.
Now, most of my patients are not on surveillance, but it is still reasonable.
Yes.
So I think with that, is there anything else that you would like to add about this case discussion?
I mean, I think the one thing I would say is for immune-related adverse events, we do find that immunosuppressive therapy is frequently delayed. So for patients who have significant immune colitis or immune pneumonitis, they usually are hospitalized. Their symptoms are that severe. So it is important to use steroids in high doses right off the bat to try and reverse that toxicity. And then in a couple of days, if they're not improving on steroids, consider switching to other immunosuppressive therapy like mycophenolate or infliximab.
Okay, so we've done a good job discussing these two cases, I hope, right? I hope the listeners and the watchers agree with that. Let's now dig a little bit into the data. So we've given you these kind of broad overviews of how we think about immunotherapy doublets and IO TKI doublets, but let's actually provide some numbers now. So here are the results of the several phase three studies, all versus sunitinib, that demonstrated benefit of IO TKI patients in advanced renal cell carcinoma. Remember, this is talking about clear cell biology. KEYNOTE-426, 861 patients who were treatment naive with advanced RCC were randomized between axitinib and pembrolizumab versus the control arm, sunitinib. The latest analysis showed that after a median follow-up of 67.2 months, axitinib and pembro continued to show superior overall survival, progression-free survival, objective response rate over sunitinib monotherapy. So, really nice separation of the curves when you take a look at this. CheckMate 214, very similar. Greater than 1,000 patients with advanced RCC were randomized to nivolumab plus ipilimumab or sunitinib in intermediate or high-risk disease. This is the immunotherapy doublet. After nearly 100 months of nivo plus ipi, continued to improve overall survival compared to sunitinib. And again, really nice sustained separation of the curves. Another thing that I would mention in favorable risk disease, you actually did see a crossing over where ipi/nivo may be providing some benefit in some of those favorable risk patients, which alludes to that conversation that we had earlier that immunotherapy is relevant in favorable risk disease. The phase three CheckMate 9ER study looked at nivolumab and cabozantinib versus sunitinib in 651 treatment naive patients. After a median follow-up of 55.6 months, nivolumab plus cabozantinib significantly prolonged median progression-free survival, right? So 16.4 versus 8.4 months, as well as median overall survival, which was 46.5 versus 36 months, respectively. In the CLEAR data set, after 4 years follow-up, the study confirmed that lenvatinib and pembrolizumab compared with sunitinib in the first-line treatment of patients with advanced RCC, median progression-free survival of 23.9 versus 23.9 months, and median overall survival of 53.7 months. I think another thing that's important here, though, is when you look at all of these combinations, let's talk about CLEAR, CheckMate 9ER, and the KEYNOTE study, KEYNOTE-426, that the hazard ratio for overall survival are all very similar, in the low 0.7s, which shows against a similar control arm that they're all performing pretty similarly. I don't think, going and looking at the differences in the numbers is the most helpful thing, because the difference in the balance of the patient population, knowing that in the CLEAR study there are more patients with favorable risk compared to poor risk, in the CheckMate 9ER study, there's more patients with poor risk, right? And then that KEYNOTE study is kind of in the middle. So knowing that there's different patient populations, the hazard ratio is, I think, more important here because what it shows is consistency of IOTKIs, but which is when we say that if you're going to select an IOTKI, it's not as important which one you select. The key is knowing how to manage that toxicity, feeling comfortable with dose reductions and modifications to keep your patient on therapy. And if you just get good with one of those frontline combinations, you're going to serve your patient well. What do you take away from those major data sets with the IOTKIs?
Yeah, I think the one big thing is that the future is very hopeful for our patients with metastatic kidney cancer. You know, we have improved the response rates. We can offer a ton of hope with the long-term remissions. Maybe down the road, we would actually have patients with long enough follow-up to be considered curative regimens with this therapy in metastatic advanced renal cell carcinoma. The few things I would mention is that, you know, the bone and liver metastases patients can be very, have tremendous morbidity from their cancer and also have limited survival. Those are things that are not captured in the IMDC criteria. So keep those in mind when you're considering the therapies for your patients, and you do need a rapid response as well as potential for long-term remission in those patients. The other thing I would mention is that all of these studies, even though, you know, the longest survival follow-up now is like 8, 9 years, I would caution that there is the survival follow-up is still immature and it's evolving. So stay tuned for future updates on each of these studies to tell us what the future brings and whether that tail end on the curve continues to be sustained after longer follow-up. The third thing I would mention is that treatment-free interval is important to consider. You know, can you give the patient a limited rate duration of treatment? Most of the VEGF TKI and IO combinations stop the IO after 2 years. That was on the study. And if you can establish this patient's remission after 2 years, it may be worthwhile having that discussion and stopping the treatment and putting the patient on surveillance potentially. The VEGF TKI can be continued if the patient has continued response and tolerability of the regimen.
Yeah, great. And I think it's important to keep in mind, you know, the toxicity rates are higher versus sunitinib. So that discussion earlier about TKI monotherapy versus IOTKI. However, we think it's justified by the net benefit that these patients are getting with, you know, disease response and disease control. Thinking about IOTKIs versus immunotherapy doublets, IOTKIs having only a very low primary progressive disease rate of somewhere between 5 to 10% across those three IOTKI combinations that we generally use that are NCCN directed, knowing that the immunotherapy doublet is closer to 20% primary progressive disease. So not quite double, but almost double versus some studies and even more than double versus other studies, right? So I think that's something to keep in mind. Does your patient need a response? If they do, an IOTKI is kind of critical, those patients with obviously liver disease and things like that. And thinking a little bit more about the therapies, right? So IOTKI combination, such as axitinib plus pembrolizumab, are associated with adverse events such as diarrhea, palmar plantar erythrodysia, also known as hand-foot syndrome, fatigue, hepatotoxicity, nausea. We've discussed how we manage some of those things. Rates of grade 3 or greater adverse events for axitinib and pembrolizumab versus sunitinib was hypertension in 22 versus 20%, elevated ALT at 13 versus less than 3% for sunitinib alone, diarrhea 11 versus 5%. So you can see some increases there. We've talked about managing those toxicities, and they're all able to do if you're monitoring your patients closely and effectively.
So we have discussed in detail with the presentation of these two cases quite a bit of the nuances of considerations of different therapies, especially since there are five different combinations that are FDA approved in the frontline setting for advanced RCC. So decisions have become complex due to expansion of therapeutic options, number of approved frontline therapies, combinations, and the absence of predictive biomarkers that will help us select therapies specifically to an individual patient. So that makes it challenging to identify the optimal combination regimen, and most of the time we have our clinical experience, adverse event management, comfort level that to go by when we pick a treatment regimen. Differentiation between IO and TKI related toxicities is vital to prevent delays in identifying and managing adverse events. Most common immune related AEs are skin and GI system. About 30% of the patients experience skin adverse reactions, so skin rashes, and 30 to 40% experience gastrointestinal adverse events, mainly immune colitis being the predominant one. Other immune-related AEs often occur in the first 3 months of treatment, but they can occur during any time during the treatment and sometimes even after you have stopped the immune checkpoint therapy. Management of mild AEs involves holding treatment until symptoms resolve. High-dose corticosteroids can be used for the treatment of moderate immune-related adverse events. And as I said, if the patient is not turning around, the toxicity is not improving quickly within the first couple of days, it may be important to switch to another immunosuppressive management. Treatment discontinuation is recommended if the patient has severe immune-related AEs that are not reversed rapidly or take a long time to get reversed, and also depending on how significant the organ dysfunction is after that immune-related AE.
Yes, thank you. Patients need to know of available treatment options, adverse events associated with treatments, and treatment expectations. This will help avoid unnecessary dose reductions and/or interruptions, because we do feel like that TKI dose can influence response. Involving patients in shared decision-making can empower them and improve treatment adherence, and shared decision-making is important, but the amount of information provided can sometimes be overwhelming. So it's careful to provide your patients key nuggets of information that they really need to take away first, that will help you manage their symptoms. Many oncologists agree that if patients are rapidly progressing, they should be treated with a combination of an IO TKI, whereas asymptomatic, younger, healthy, fit patients sometimes can be considered for immunotherapy doublets. Metastatic renal cell carcinoma can present with a broad range of symptoms. The site of metastases was not included as a risk factor in RCC. However, liver, bone, and brain metastases are likely to have a worse prognosis. Patients with these metastases usually need a combination of a VEGF TKI and immune therapy in order to develop that initial response. Brain metastases are first treated with local therapy, with surgery or radiation, or both, and then systemic therapy is started. Axitinib plus pembrolizumab represents one of several new standards of care in the treatment of advanced RCC. Adverse events must be effectively managed to help patients remain on their treatment and derive optimal clinical benefit. Thank you. So in summary, multiple VEGF TKI and immune checkpoint therapy regimens are FDA approved in frontline metastatic renal cell carcinoma. Each of these regimens has shown superiority over sunitinib, but none of them have been compared. Nivo plus ipilimumab is FDA approved for intermediate and poor risk renal cell carcinoma. And shared therapeutic decision-making must consider multiple factors in addition to IMDC risk criteria, such as disease location, how symptomatic is your patient when you're making those decisions.
And patient comorbidities clearly play a role. We gave you that example with the cardiac disease that our patient had. Also, social and caregiver support is very important. You need to be having the discussion with the caregivers along with the patients so they are informed, well informed about their side effects and what to expect and how to monitor the patient. Other patient concerns and overall therapy goals are important to discuss, and ultimately, it is a shared decision making with your patient about treatment choice. So take home points It is important to be aware of the adverse events, have a balanced, detailed discussion with the patient and about the nuances of immune checkpoint-based regimens or the IO-TKI regimen, and manage the patient carefully through the treatment and monitor for both response as well as side effects. The future does look bright for advanced RCC. We are clearly not curing everybody, and we have a number of novel therapies. So I would make a final pitch that the only way we can improve therapy or current management in kidney cancer is through clinical trials. So participation in clinical trials that have brought us all these advances remains a very important piece of the management of patients.
Yes, I think that's a critical point. Clinical trials are essential to provide access to those patients. So always consider them in the front line as well as in subsequent lines of therapy. And the final thing I would like to say is help patients help you. Give them criteria of when to call your clinic and have them bring a blood pressure cuff home.
Great. Thank you, Ben.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.